Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to Hometown Heroes, the show where each week we get a personal glimpse into the most tumultuous time in world history. If you listen to the show often, you've heard quite a few World War II veterans share their experiences, but you haven't heard too many stories like the one we heard last week with 90-year-old Pete Houck remembering what it was like to be on Omaha Beach on D-Day. If you missed that show, go to kmjnow.com, listen to the podcast. You can do that anytime, but if you're going to listen to today's show, you're going to want to at some point go back and listen to last week's show. We are continuing Pete's story this week. We've already heard about his secret mission to the beach hours before the official D-Day assault actually began. We've heard about the carnage that he witnessed on that beach, the daring way in which his team of engineers took out two German bunkers there. And we heard Pete share about that young lady named Beverly that he had proposed to back in Pocatello, Idaho, the girl that wrote him a letter a day for 2 years. Some of those letters remain unopened still today. You can read much more about that, see some photos of the Houcks at kmjnow.com. Also, the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. All the photos are there on Facebook. But let's get back to Pete's story right now. And I know that the story is going to take a dramatic turn once we get to December 25th and you're wounding on Christmas Day. Mm-hmm. But from Normandy to the Battle of the Bulge, your outfit, the 502nd, was pretty busy, right? What kinds of things were you doing?
Our main thing was to build bridges fast enough. You see, when the Germans left an area or retreated, they blew up any crossing so that we couldn't use our equipment. One of the reasons that our company was sent in was that we were noted for the fact that we could build a bridge 165 feet long over a ravine, whether it was a canyon or a river or whatever, in less than 3 hours and have it prepared to take small tanks, trucks, and jeeps. And we could do it two a day if we had to, if we had the equipment. Many of them we built at night. Now, they're steel. So remember, at night, you don't want to make a lot of noise because if you do, you could have 88 shells in your hip pocket.
You could have some other steel heading your way.
That's right. So we used leather hammers. Mm-hmm. The hammers were about 3 pounds. And that bridge was so well built that everything just fit. And it was all built by hand.
And for you specifically, in terms of, I mean, I'm assuming every guy had a different job in putting that bridge together that fast. So what was your specific duty? Was it the same every time you did a bridge? Did you have to know a variety of roles? How did that work?
My role was to line up the detonation, set the detonation, make a map to show where the charge could be set from, and then put the charge on the steel as it was going across.
On every single bridge, you had to do that?
Yeah.
Were you ever responsible for detonating it too? Or that?
No, but I've detonated a lot of stuff.
Now, you say that with a wry smile on your face, as if you enjoyed some of those detonations.
I know I speak of Earl Couch a lot because if you bunk with a guy and sleep in the sand with him and dig a hole and sleep with him and eat with him, talk with him every day, you get to be pretty close. So he was my right-hand man, and I was his left-hand man, I guess. But we were going to make a CP for the officers, and it was an old building made out of concrete and rock. The first thing you do is you check the doors and windows to make sure there's no booby traps or anything like that. And I didn't see it, but Earl did. There was a small wire up in the upper left-hand corner of the door, and he said, well, let's wait a minute. Let's check this out. So we checked that had a little pressure switch on it, so we clipped the switch off, opened the door, and over on the table was an open bottle of wine and two glasses.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's an indication, of course, for you to take a quick sip. But we looked underneath the table, and there was a tripwire there, and we followed it into the basement, and there were several boxes of old dynamite hooked to it. So we just went off about 100 yards, hooked our own detonator to it, and blew the whole damn thing up.
That would have been a pretty costly sip of wine, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would have. Yeah, would have taken us both.
And was that just the result of training?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. We, you know, when we were trained, and this is one of the things that I wonder about some of the men that get into, came to us as kids, whether they got that much. But we actually went in rooms with different types of gases so we could detect them and smell them and know about them. And you get your, make your eyes run, your nose run. And we also were taught how to take these things apart backward and forward and blindfolded.
Mm-hmm. I believe.
So we really knew what we were doing. See, I had I had boot camp, and then I went on maneuvers, and then it was almost 2 years in June, so I had a lot of training before I ever hit Omaha.
And it sounds like in probably more than one instance, that training probably saved your life.
Absolutely.
Now, I know we're bouncing around here and there, but I rerouted you earlier when you started to talk about the impregnated clothing that you were issued, because after you make the landing on Omaha Beach on June 6th, was it the next day you were told that?
I think the third day.
The third day they told you that you might be gassed by German forces, so they gave you something else to wear?
Well, they flew over us and dropped by paratroopers, dropped impregnated clothing. And this consisted of a long underwear, the kind with the trap door in the back, and socks and shirts and our outfit, to fatigues and everything. And they were all felt like they'd been in paraffin, you know, the kind that they used to seal old jars with.
Right.
This material was so dense that air couldn't get to your body. You couldn't stand the odor that came out through your shirt top. And if you put your hand on your bare skin inside your shirt and you brought it out, it would be wet and with skin, and you couldn't stand the odor. And we wore those until they decided that they weren't going to gas us, which was 6 weeks later when we hit St. Lo. No, St. Lo wasn't much left of it when we got there. So the captain had asked us if we were, you know, knowledgeable enough to hook up the water system and create some showers. And we got 12 of them going. Cold, of course, but man, it was a shower. And there were about 200 of our company there at that time. And the captain said, okay, you guys, we're going to give you clean clothes and you can strip. In less than 5 minutes, there were 200 naked guys standing there screaming for the shower.
You were glad to be rid of those gas suits.
Oh, yes.
Well, and the purpose, you talk about how dense it was. It needed to be dense to keep the poison gas out.
Yeah.
Sure.
Right.
But in the meantime, it basically cooked you guys and made you pruny all over.
Oh,
sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, the memories. and so that was at St. Lo, where, of course, the famous breakout had occurred, and that city was devastated. And I know you had some detonating to do there, and you guys kept moving on. Anything else? I don't want to gloss over anything before we get to the Battle of the Bulge, but were there any other close calls or close encounters or things that just really have stuck in your memory for all these years that you witnessed along that journey?
Well, one thing I was involved in that I wasn't too happy about, the day we went into France or into Paris, we were very well greeted by the people, but we were instructed that we were to build reviewing stands, if you can believe, in the middle of a damn war for De Gaulle and Eisenhower, and that galled a lot of us. So we took 3 days out of fighting to build these reviewing stands so they could have a big parade. while guys are out in the middle of a battlefield, you know. I think that upset a lot of us guys, especially the 502nd. You know, we were a fighting outfit. We weren't building grandstands, for God's sake.
You felt like you could have used that time a little more productively for the war effort.
Yeah.
Sure.
But see, I believe that they'd made a pact or some kind of an agreement with de Gaulle that he was to be the big hero.
Right.
Because then he would go on politically and become the president of the country and whatever. But we got into a big problem on the Rhine, and the Argonne Forest was a mess. But that was the edge of the Battle of the Bulge, which started in December.
December 16th, 1944. And where were you when you heard that this was happening?
We were trying to build a road over 4 foot of mud in the forest. Again, I'll bring up Earl Couch, who was a graduate of Osawatomie, Kansas, and he was an engineer, a graduate engineer. And he went to the captain and told him, you know, he said, I can show you how to build this road. And, of course, they greeted him with open arms. So what our group did was put C2 around the 12-inch trunks of these pine trees. Now, remember, in those countries, they plant their pine trees. Mm-hmm. They're all planted. So what we were doing was falling them left and right and then lacing them together with cables. This area was about a mile and a half. We were probably 20 miles from Luxembourg. Mm-hmm. And if you got out of your vehicle or you were in the mud, it was right up to your kneecaps.
Fun.
Yeah, it was a mess. But that was the night that I said the Lord's Prayer.
That's when they were...
They were really giving it to us that night, yeah.
So you were there in the Ardennes Forest.
Yes.
When the fighting began.
Oh, yeah.
So that 88 fire that you described was basically the start of the Battle of the Bulge.
Right.
And... Not only were you up to your knees in mud, it was probably starting to get kind of cold, too.
It was very cold. We had what we called September clothing. I can't remember. They couldn't fly anything in there, but it all had to come by truck. And even then, it was kind of dangerous because the fog was so bad. But most of those trucks and men were well-trained. They could drive with an azimuth, you know. I've driven up a fire line many times after dark for miles.
That sounds like some nervous driving.
It is.
So the Battle of the Bulge has started.
Mm-hmm.
Christmas is coming.
Yep.
I've heard some very interesting stories from soldiers who are at the Battle of the Bulge about what Christmas was like wherever they were. I don't know if Christmas 1944 is a day that you like to remember or not. Tell us what you remember about that Christmas day. I'm sure you woke up thinking about Beverly and all your family back home, right?
Let me get a little ahead of that.
Sure.
When we were leaving the Ardennes after building this mud bridge, we called it, we left there sometime early morning. It was still dark. And we drove to Liège. And we knew something was on. It had to be the 17th or the 18th, maybe later. Time, we don't know. I don't know. But... as daybreak came, there were hundreds of doctors and nurses and patients laying in the streets, still bleeding. The Germans had sent through a battalion of their army, all dressed in American uniforms, and they slaughtered everybody that was there.
Mm. So when you saw all those doctors and nurses and you saw all these patients, these wounded soldiers sprawled all over the snow. That was the aftermath of the Malmedy massacre?
That was right, yeah. It was just, they probably were there just a few hours ahead of us because blood doesn't run that long.
That's true. So had you been a few hours different, there's another instance where you would have been slain just like they were.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But he wasn't, and aren't we all thankful for that? There are about 30 people who would have never been born if that had been the case, but thankfully, it was not the case. And we have much more to hear from 90-year-old Pete Houck. How was he wounded? How bad was it? And how long did it take him to get home and marry that pretty young lady who was waiting for him back home? We'll get those answers and much more when Hometown Heroes continues next here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and part two of our conversation with 90-year-old Pete Houck of Fresno, California. Remember, if you missed last week's program where Pete talks about his intense experiences on Omaha Beach on D-Day, some of those very emotional recollections, you can access that online at kmjnow.com. When we left off before the break, Pete had shared about the start of the Battle of the Bulge, how he experienced that, and how as he moved from one location to another with the 502nd Engineers, he came across that awful aftermath of the Malmedy Massacre. We're going to pick up the interview right there with the roads that he traveled from there until the war came to an end a little early for him.
But anyway, we left there and I went to Holland. They were afraid the Germans were going to come on through to Antwerp. And we were in Holland, I think, 4 days, blowing up bridges and making it real tough for them to come forward. And then I went back to Liège to help out at the Battle of the Bulge. And that night, Lieutenant White had asked for two volunteers, and he pointed to Earl Couch and me, and he said, "You guys see if you can't get some ammo and some blankets into Bastogne." And he said, "We'll set you up with some extra gear." So we started out about nightfall. And driving with a compass, we got into the first checkpoint. They asked us, of course, the password, and we told them it was Butterfly that night. And we unloaded everything there and then turned and went back. Now, I drove in heading the team, and Earl Couch drove back out. We got out onto one of the highways into Liège. And I'd like to back up a little. My wife had sent me, or my future wife had sent me, a can of Planters peanuts, and we were going to save them for Christmas Day. And Earl Couch, his mother, had baked him a loaf of bread and hadn't finished baking it and put a bottle of Schlitz in the loaf of bread. And so we were saving those for Christmas Day. And we got out onto this little highway, and I could see Earl waving his hand as motion to stop. And so you stop about 200 yards apart, between 100 and 200. And he said, "Hey, it's Christmas. Get the peanuts." And I reached up, picked up the peanuts, turned around, shut the door. And then the next thing I remember, Earl Couch was holding me in his arms. A lone 88 had hit the bar pit on the right-hand side of this big truck. Apparently, I was close to the tire, front tire, when it happened. And most of the shrapnel that got to me went through everything else. So I only had some small holes in my back, about 18, I think they said. But it had collapsed my right lung. I know I went to Liège because he said, I'm just taking off for Liège with you now. But I never remembered Liège. The next thing I remembered, I was in a padded cell in the hospital in Paris. And this beautiful woman come in, a little nurse. I said, "You got me all strapped down here." And she said, "Yes, and we're going to keep you there until you act like a gentleman." And I said, "Well, what did I do?" And she said, "Well, you were so bad with battle fatigue," she said, "you wouldn't let anybody touch you."
Wow.
So I stayed there for 3 months. And in April the next year, I came home and I married my wife April the 22nd, 1945.
And every April 22nd now, you guys open another one of those letters that Beverly wrote you while you were overseas.
That's true.
Now, so you're wounded, you're in the hospital, and thankfully, I guess you don't have any recollections of
how I got there.
How you got there or what it was like, and obviously you were behaving in a way that they found hard to handle.
Yeah.
And that was not uncommon at that time. No. A lot of guys dealt with that.
They call it battle fatigue.
We've heard of guys being shell-shocked, and now, of course, we know PTSD.
Yeah.
Is that something that you ever had to deal with again in all the years since?
As you know, I go to the VA. They mm-hmm. take care of me, and they have very, very well. And I once in a while, I have a little problem, and I go and go to a psychiatrist. Most of my problems are at night, but Beverly wakes me up, and I usually wringing wet with sweat.
I don't bring it up. I know it's not something that's fun to talk about, but it's real. And I've known so many men who have dealt with this for decades after the war. My grandfather was the same way, nightmares for years and years and years.
Yeah.
And I think it's important for the rest of us to realize the price, not only that you paid then, but that you've really paid since then. And it does take a toll on you, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'll have one, I'm sure, tonight.
Thanks to me bringing all this up for you. And I apologize. Well, that makes us all the more appreciative for you and your willingness to talk about all this. And I want to ask about something a little more pleasant. You just kind of referenced it. All that time in the hospital, at some point you remember, hey, there's a girl back home who's going to marry me, and now I got this million-dollar wound. I'm going to go back there, and I'm going to seal the deal. So what was it like when you actually saw her again? Where were you? How'd you meet up?
Well, of course, when Earl took me to Liège, I was put on AWOL, or lost in action. So my mother was sent a letter that I was lost in action, or a wire. And she advised Beverly and the family. And they did not hear from me. I think it was in February.
So they didn't know if you were alive or dead?
No. So I wasn't receiving any of her mail. I hadn't received her mail, though, since August. I hadn't been in a position to where I could receive mail.
Sure. You know?
And so I wrote to her and told her I was in the hospital, but not to worry. And, of course, that's the first thing that they do. As soon as you tell them, don't worry, they worry.
Of course.
But I called her when I got to New York. That was a beautiful sight. I was in a wheelchair, and they wheeled me up on top deck, and we went by the Statue of Liberty. And they had boats shooting water and firecrackers and, mm-hmm. and 21-gun salutes. And that was a nice time. And I was in New York, and I called my mother, and when she heard my voice, she passed out.
Wow.
So my dad got on the phone, and he said, now who the hell is this? Here his wife was laying on the floor. And I said, it's your son, Philip. Of course, he broke up. And so when they got all shook up, I thought, well, I better not call Beverly. I'll send her a wire. So I sent her a wire, and she got it at lunchtime when she came home from work. So she wasn't able to go back to work. I called her that evening, and she said, I'm going to be on the next train. Mm-hmm. She said, I'm coming to New York. And I said, well, don't. She said, well, I want to see you. I'm coming. And I said, no, because they're going to take me to DeWitt General Hospital in Auburn. It was a lung hospital at that time in Auburn, California, and it was mm-hmm. closer to my home.
Yeah.
My parents. And I said, why don't you just wait till I get there? And she said, well, you'll have to come through Ogden. Let me come and see you on the train. And I said, well, honey, I don't think they're going to let you close to that train. You know, there'll be guards all over.
Right.
Can't you just wait? She did, finally. Then when I got to DeWitt General, I said, you know, I said, I've been engaged for 3 years, and my future spouse, my wife, wants me to come and see her and to get married. And the doctor said, well, I've met a lot of damn fools in my time. But he said, a man still in the hospital wanting to get married is a little bit out of my reach. But he said, if you think you can make the trip, I'll give you a 10-day pass. They took me down to Sacramento, and I got on a train there, and Beverly came to Ogden from Pocatello.
Ogden, Utah.
Yeah, and, uh-huh. and met me in Ogden. A printer wore out my kisser, I think. But we've had a wonderful life.
And did you have to go back to the hospital after that?
Oh, yeah, sure. I, I was still a patient. And so then Beverly and I drove, we didn't have a car, but I had $300, and I bought a 1939 Ford Coupe, V8 Ford Coupe, for $295. It was in pretty good shape for an old car. And we drove to DeWitt General, and I got her a place to stay in town. And I was still on the base, but weekends I could get away, and she'd come out once or twice during the week, and we'd go to a movie or something. And that was in April. In May, I was discharged, the latter part of May.
And have those injuries that you suffered had any lingering effects on you physically?
Well, I wanted to be a butcher, and of course I was a tradesman for a butcher, but the government wouldn't allow that because of my lung condition.
Mm.
They decided that they would retrain me. And I went to work for Prudential Life Insurance Company and became a very successful insurance man. But I was going back to college and taking marketing, and I ended up in the advertising business.
Mm-hmm.
And I trained sales personnel that have been all over the United States.
And you've also written a few children's books.
Well, that was a funny thing. I started, you know, with Westerns.
Uh-huh.
My grandmother walked across the United States behind a wagon, and she made notes of that walk.
Hmm.
And in my father's old trunk, one day when I was pushed into cleaning the garage by my beautiful wife, I ran across this old trunk. And I don't think I've cleaned that garage, come to think about it. Anyway, in my father's old trunk was these notes from my grandmother. And I decided to write a story, a Western, and I called it The Saga of Peter Houston.
All right.
I mixed in there some of my knowledge I learned and experienced in the service, some of Grandma's story, some true. So it was a novel, and it was quite successful. So I was asked to write a second. So I wrote a sequel to it. And I was passing those out one Christmas evening to my adult kids, because they're adult books. And my little five-year-old great-granddaughter came up to me and said, Papa, where's my book?
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, honey, these are for adults. I said, I don't think Grandpa could write a children's story. She walked away, and she came back, stood right in front of me with her hands on her hips, and she said, well, you could if you wanted to. Now, that put the B on me.
You had no choice at that point.
No. I said, do you know that my remark was, you're plumb full of prunes. And she walked away, but about 3 o'clock, I got the call at night and went to the bathroom. And when I came back, I'm staring at the ceilings, and I thought, you little rascal, but a plum full of prunes might be a pretty good story. So in my pajamas, I went into my office and started. And in those days, I didn't have a computer. I was doing it by hand. I started a story. Plum full of prunes.
Uh-huh.
Now, today, that book has changed the marketing of prunes.
Now, that sounds like a story in itself, doesn't it? We need to step away, but when we come back, we'll hear how Pete connects all those dots. If you would like to check out any of Pete's books, those Westerns, or the beautifully illustrated and, yes, well-written children's books, I have a link on our website, kmjnow.com. You can even read a little article about Pete, the author, on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And when we come back, Pete is going to wrap up that story. He'll tell us what it was like to return to Normandy for the 50th anniversary of the invasion. And he'll also reflect on the big picture of everything we've heard from this hometown hero the last 2 weeks. Again, if you missed last week's descriptions of all those intense moments on Omaha Beach, you can hear it all online at kmjnow.com. And we'll be right back with the rest of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. It has been such a pleasure sharing Pete Hauk's story with you the last 2 weeks. You know, sometimes veterans bristle at the title of this show because, as Pete will tell you, it's their firm conviction that the real heroes of World War II are the more than 400,000 Americans who never came home, the ones who paid that ultimate price for our freedom. But those of us who weren't around then, those of us who owe our freedom today to the sacrifices of the greatest generation, as well as the brave men and women carrying on their legacy today in our all-volunteer armed forces, we can look to them as heroes. They're heroes in our eyes, and they're all around us. I've been interviewing veterans around the Valley for years, but I never would have known about Pete's story if his next-door neighbor hadn't written me a letter to tell me some of the stories Pete had shared with him. Wherever your hometown is, there are heroes around you, too. And remember, if you have somebody you want to tell me about, you can email me, paul@kmjnow.com, paul@kmjnow.com. And I'll put them on my list. Well, let's get back to Pete's story now. It has been 66 years since World War II, so he's had plenty of time for other adventures. He today has a backyard garden with some great-looking tomatoes, cucumbers, and the like. In the past, he's had fruit orchards. And when we left off, he was telling us that the book his great-granddaughter inspired has had an impact on the prune industry. Or maybe we should say the dried plum industry. You can link to that book, Plum Full of Prunes, on our website, kmjnow.com. But Pete, let's hear it. What's the scoop about the unintended impact that book has had?
I was called 5 years ago by the USDA saying to me, you're going to have to verify the statements you made in your book that there's no such a thing as a prune. And I said, well, that's not a problem. So they said, well, you'll have to, you know, send us some information that's true.
Right.
And I said, well, that's easy. So I went down to the library where I got all the information. And the professor and who ended up being the president of the College of New York had written a story about 40 New York plums in 18-something. And in there is a story of the De-Asian plum that, of course, come from Asia. And they used to let it ripen and dry on the tree and use it as fruit and as fruit that they traveled with.
Mm-hmm.
So when the monks were forced out of Asia from France in the later 1800s, they brought these plums with them and planted them along the Lot River in France. And when a gold rush happened in the United States, the Pelaire brothers came to America looking for gold and didn't find gold. But in the Santa Clara Valley, not far from San Jose, they found a soil that was exactly like that of their country land and where these plums grew. So Lewis went back and brought his bride and cuttings from those trees to America. And they, when people asked them what they were grafting the Santa Clara plum trees with, they said pruneres, because that's the word for plums in their area.
Mm-hmm.
So we picked it up, us Americans, as a prune.
So there's really no such thing as a prune?
No.
They're all just plums.
And there are farmers today that are listening to your program that'll say, well, this guy is nuts. But I can prove it. And as of 2 years now, since the USDA finally made a decision, there will be no more prunes. Matter of fact, in the stores today, it has prunes and plums on the same package,
yeah,
which needs
plums
to be done until the fifth year. And that's the way the ball bounces.
And it was your book that got that rolling?
Mm-hmm.
Was there a certain person who read your book that,
well,
how'd it go from there, yeah, or how'd that process start?
That's kind of odd, too. I'm really sorry I can't remember the man's name, whether it was Jensen or Hansen. But when I was writing this story, I mentioned it to someone, and they said, you should talk to him. So when I did, he said, well, you should talk to the prune industry. So I went to San Francisco, and I took some of my book, it wasn't finished, mm-hmm. and some of the artwork, and went there and told them my story. I had it finished, had the story finished, but it wasn't ready for publication. And they went out of the room and came back in, and they said, we'll take 10,000 before you go to press.
Now, as someone who's written a book and had it do pretty well, 10,000 books before it ever goes to press, that's unthinkable, especially for something you're putting together itself. Wow, that's incredible.
For a granddaughter. That's crazy.
And I hope she got a royalty from all your sales.
Yeah. I went to her. She lives in Oregon. And I called her school teacher to see if I could come up and read the book to their class. And, of course, they were thrilled. And her eyes were as big as cantaloupe. She was so proud. I was too.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned your great-granddaughter, because obviously anyone who's been paying attention to your story knows that you easily could have been killed on June 6th of 1944. The shrapnel that ended up in your back on Christmas Day of 44, I understand, still occasionally makes its way out through the skin. Your wife's had to pick a few pieces out of your back?
Yes, she did, but that was a few years back. I don't think I've had any lately, not for the last 10 or 20 years maybe. But every once in a while, I would climb out of the shower, you know, and she'd say, oh, you've got a pimple. And then she'd say, no, what is this? And then she'd take a tweezer, and be a little tiny piece of metal that worked its way through. Yeah.
Thanks to those 88s.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Exactly.
Their best piece of equipment.
And so if you wouldn't have lived through all that, survived all that, made it home, you and Beverly never would have been married. Three children, 12 grandchildren, 14 great-grandchildren, and two great-great-grandkids. So that's 31 people who would have never been born.
Probably not. No, they wouldn't have. No.
Isn't that something?
Well, sometimes we make a mark and at least realize it.
Wow, I think you've made a mark in a lot of places, Pete. And as we wrap this up, I've got to ask, when you think about that, when you think about that legacy I just described of 31 people who wouldn't be here if someone hadn't been looking out for you during World War II, everything that you've experienced, including the great story about the book you just shared, how do you make sense of all that? Why do you think you had the fortune to get through what you got through and to have the life you've led?
Well, a lot of people may not believe this, but I believe that all of us have a spirit. And if we follow our spirit and are true to ourself, which comes first, we're true to others. And if we're true to others, we're really following the Bible and we're following what Christ was trying to teach us. Mm-hmm. And I believe that because I've lived with that thought in my mind, and I've treated others as I would like to be treated, that's probably why. He's probably not through with me yet.
I wouldn't think so. You're only 90. You got more letters to open on the rest of your anniversaries. You're not done yet.
Yeah, I got tomatoes to grow.
There you go. Yeah, but not prunes.
Yeah, and you know, I have a great club that I've belonged to. I'm their oldest member, I think. I joined in Pocatello, Idaho, the Exchange Club, which is a national businessmen's club. Mm-hmm. And I joined them in 1951. And when I transferred to Fresno in 1960, I carried that on, and I'm still a member of that club, a past president of that club. I regard that club as personal friends, along with the great things they do for our community. And I hail that club. They hail me.
I'm sure they're all listening to you say that, and they're all cheering for you. I I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, too, about something else that certainly was, I know, neat for you to experience. In a few years, we'll have the 70th anniversary of D-Day. But on the 50th anniversary, the government actually paid to send you back there with some other veterans. What was the highlight of that for you, and what did it mean to you to be back there 50 years after everything you experienced?
Well, of course, I didn't know what to expect. And although I didn't pay for Beverly, I took her with me, of course. And we were walking around. If you've ever been to that monument, it's almost a mile from where the monument sits on the top of the rim of the beach. That's about 400 yards from the water. And then it goes back, I'm going to say, over a mile. And it's all beautiful lawn and landscaped. And they had chairs all the way back. And the podium was right up, of course, by the monument. And Beverly and I were probably a half a mile from the monument walking. And when the government had offered me to go, they sent me a little badge to wear and a duplicate for Beverly. And one of the ushers said, do you know where you're supposed to go? And I said, no, but I said, we're looking for a seat. Oh, he said, sir, you don't sit here. He said, do you look way up there at the front? He said, do you see those Marines elbow to elbow? Well, he said, you go up there and you ask those Marines to be seated. So Beverly and I walked up there, and I walked up to this young lieutenant, and I said, could you tell me where I'm to be seated? And he looked at me for a long time. And he said, sir, any damn place you want, this beach belongs to you. So they parted, and two Marines walked us up to the front of the podium, and I sat with, maybe five chairs from the president, and with the Congress on the left. It was a memorable time. But it brought back a lot of memories. I don't want to go back again. It's beautiful now. Even the beach is beautiful. There's only one old rotten ship out there. I wish they'd take it out and sink it someplace. You know, today, there's still men buried there.
Mm-hmm.
They had designed a flotilla for tanks because they were worried about that channel in the high water. And they thought they could float them ashore. But the men and the tanks and the floats all went to the bottom. Never worked.
And I sense the reason you don't want to go back again is it's too hard to think about all the guys that are still there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, is there anything else that you'd like to share with us for people that weren't there, that didn't experience what you did, what you want people to know when you think about your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids and great-great-grandkids, what you want them to remember about the guys like you who were there and did what you did?
I would like you to remember that had we not won that day, our lives in this country and across the world would very definitely have been different, even to the point that you may have been speaking German today. And to remember that those men gave their lives that we might have freedom. Freedom's not cheap.
And you certainly know that, and you've certainly made the most of the freedom that you helped pay for all those many years ago. Pete, thank you for serving our country. Thank you for having the courage to go back there with us to talk about some very tough stuff. And have a whole lot more anniversaries so you can finish that box of letters for us, all right?
Thank you.
That's Pete Hauk. He's been our guest today. If you want to listen to either one of these installments as we went all the way through two programs with Pete. You can find those at kmjnow.com.
We'll be back next week with another Valley veteran of World War II, and I don't need to tell you that that's 4th of July weekend next weekend as we celebrate our nation's birthday. Let's remember to thank the people we know who are serving or have served in our armed forces, helping keep our great nation free and prospering for all these years. I'll tell you, it was refreshing this week to be in San Diego. Well, that in itself was refreshing, but to sit there with my family getting ready to watch Shamu at SeaWorld, and before any of those orcas got to work, the handler took time. First thing out of her mouth was to have military personnel stand and be recognized. Very refreshing. And hey, if you're buying fireworks for the 4th of July, there are several military organizations raising money. I'm sure there's one in your hometown. They're raising money by selling fireworks, like the Clovis VFW. You can find their stand on 3rd Street, just east of Clovis Avenue in Clovis. Just east of Clovis Avenue on 3rd Street, the Clovis VFW will be selling their fireworks June 30th through the 4th, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. every one of those days. So go visit them, buy some fireworks, and don't forget to thank them for serving our country. I'm Paul Leffler, thanking you for listening and inviting you back at this same time next week for another edition of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.